Sunstone does not necessarily endorse the opinions expressed in these presentations, nor the character of the presenters. Presenters must follow Sunstone's code of conduct, available online at bit.ly/sunstoneconduct. Those who violate it are thereafter banned from Sunstone events. Since this session was recorded, multiple people reported having been sexually abused by panelist Tom Kimball. To provide opportunities to learn from the past and to keep the historical record intact, Sunstone will continue to make this session available. For more information, visit sunstone.org/connect/news. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual assault, call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673.
Welcome to Session 63. This is Stages of Faith, a Mormon Encounter, if you're in the right place. I'm Chris Conkling, and our speaker will be Tom Kimball. Tom is from American Fork. He's a marketing director at Signature Books, editor for the Journal of Mormon History, and also, I guess, sold rare books for quite a while with Kurt Bench. He'll speak on this book by, what's his name, Fowler? James Fowler. I remember a few years ago, I picked up this little Catholic book called Faith is a Virtue. And in there, they talked about this Fowler who had analytically dissected faith. And I thought that was sort of an oxymoron. You know, how do you... Faith is not... But I actually Xeroxed his whole paradigm and the different stages of faith, and I handed it out to all the seminary kids. I don't know if they got anything out of it. But I got a lot out of it, so I'm really anxious to learn more about it today. Hopefully I told the kids something that was true. I guess I'll find out. But it's too late now anyway. They're long gone. Damage has been done. Then Dan Witherspoon will reply to him.
Sorry.
Dan got his BA from BYU in philosophy, MA from Arizona State Religious Studies, PhD from Claremont, right here. He's worked teaching community colleges on philosophy and ethics, and he's been the editor at Sunstone for the past 3 years, married for 18 years with two children. One other announcement to give you is that if you want to buy a book, they're going to pack up the books not right after this session, but right after the next session. So if you haven't bought any books by about 6:10 or 6:15, they'll be gone for the night. So maybe between this session is the time to get those orders in. And then the only thing to always remind you is we'll repeat the questions for the tape, or if you have hopefully a question, not a long alternative sermon. But if you have a question, we'll repeat it into the tape, or you can come up and repeat it. So with that, we'll turn it over. Thanks.
Hi. We brought two books at the book table of the book I'll be talking about, if anyone's interested. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pyrian spring. Their shallow droughts intoxicate the brain, but drinking largely sobers us again. In 1995, I began employment as Christmas gift at the LDS Church on Deseret bookstore. By nature, I've always enjoyed talking about Mormon history and issues. Like the nymphs at the Pyrians, I found it intoxicating to introduce ideas and books to people who would approach me with doctrinal, historical, and spiritual questions. The very nature of being an LDS book salesman and a gatekeeper of hidden knowledge, for me, was the equivalent of being a rock star. Each time I read a new book or gave a customer a sales pitch, I had the opportunity to rethink a Mormon concept or point of history. I think it's natural that someone who really cares about Mormon books and issues would in time dovetail Mormon ideas into a complex, personalized worldview that, in spite of any dangling loose ends, would fit together like a carefully woven tapestry. I found that I often formulated new ideas as I spoke as a salesman. I would often try on new ideas for size in the process of selling books. Once I mentioned to a regular client, if a person reads Mormon books and really cares about what they say, there only seems to be two paths for a person, fundamentalism and agnosticism. The problem was that I had read these books myself and was aware of many of the issues and problems, yet at the time I didn't feel like I was necessary on either of these paths. Yet the polar concepts of fundamentalism and agnosticism became my only yardstick. Which I could discuss what I perceived as the ultimate outcome of any well-read Mormon experience. Enter James Fowler. While cleaning, sorting, and pricing used volumes at Benchmark Books, Dan Witherspoon and I would often talk about philosophy and the implications of our Mormon model. Dan's PhD is in the philosophy of religion, and we talked about shamans, Nietzsche, Joseph Smith, and how different cultures perceive the path of life and what it all means. During one of these sessions, Dan had mentioned that he had met James Fowler on an airplane, and we began discussing his book, Stages of Faith, which Fowler based in part on 600 lengthy interviews he and a team of researchers conducted with men, women, children from ages 4 to 88, including Jews, Catholics, Protestants, agnostics, and atheists. Though Fowler is not a Mormon, his six stages fit nicely within my tradition, and this paper is an attempt to provide a Mormon example of his work. So, through Fowler, I've been able to nuance and transform my either-or theory into what I think is a healthier tool for defining the Mormon path. I do find that I almost exclusively use Fowler's stages 3 through 5, as they are the stages that relate to me specifically. I realize that these stages aren't actual things, but merely a framework to illustrate human development as it unfolds in a predictable sequence. A person must spend time in every stage, and each is necessary as it builds on the previous stage. Fowler's stages of faith concept has made it possible for me to be more charitable with those who have been critical of me and my doubts, and has given me quite possibly the only lifeline which might lead me back to a belief in God and to feel comfortable within the culture of my youth and heritage. Fowler calls stage 1 the intuitive projective stage. Fowler suggests that this is representative of 2 to 6-year-olds. At this stage, the child interlinks myth with reality. Early in life, a child is unable to differentiate where the myth begins and where reality ends. It's the time of asking what and why ad nauseum. It's also where the child learns if the world is a safe environment, and where the child learns to trust or not to trust, as is unfortunately all too often the case. This introduction is an important step towards the second stage. Fowler called stage 2 the mythic literal stage, where the child works to separate the real from the make-believe and to form a narrative of one's life. Stories are important in this stage, and the child can be trapped in the narrative, though still not able to draw from them conclusions about the general meaning of life. This is a healthy stage for those in the age range of 2 to 12. Those in stage 2 also have a them or us tribal concept that is often void of the complexities of a diverse community. This tribal concept gives justification to the individual to view those who are not the us, who are not us, to mean less than equal, and in extreme cases, even in the same category as animals and insects, certainly not as equals. The other exists, but can easily be hated or forgotten. Stage 3, or the synthetic conventional stage, is of course the most interesting stage. Fowler talks about it in terms of the individual trusting the group for social ideas and standards. An individual in this stage will trust a parent or institution that has dedicated significant time and energy into formulating these standards, or that the group's concepts come directly from God and the individual only needs to defer to the group's teachings as truth. I like to call this stage the return missionary stage, as I view a fully developed stage 3 Mormon as someone much like a return missionary who has a full sense of why Mormonism works. They would have gained from parents, church leaders, a complex understanding of the LDS plan of salvation. They have confidence in the purpose of life and have a sense as to why good and bad things happen in the lives of people. They can articulate why God created the universe, the purpose of humanity, and why he or she has an integral and meaningful place within that plan. For Latter-day Saints, worldview can be very complex and gives meaning not only to the metaphysical events of life, but also to the rational science behind God's creative power and motivations. This very nature of the Latter-day Saint worldview is so vast that there appears to be no end to the breadth and width of its complexity. For Mormons, this is a very comfortable stage to be in. Importantly, Fowler points out that most adults never leave this stage. Stage 4, or the individuative reflective faith, is described as when a person shakes off community and social pressures and begins to choose for themselves whether something is true or not, regardless of the group's social norms. In a specific Latter-day Saint context, this can be when the individual begins to explore the loose ends of Mormonism and begins to pick at them in an effort to tidy them up in his or her mind. This is especially true for those in the Mormon book culture. For example, It's not hard to find quotes by Brigham Young and others who say that the Adam-God concept will have to be accepted by everyone, and how important it is in explaining the nature of God, and then just as easily find statements by Orson Pratt and Bruce R. McConkie denouncing the same doctrine as ill-conceived, false, if not outright heresy. These convictions invite readers to make decisions one way or another that will ultimately place them at odds with the ideologies of a significant portion of their culture. A better example may be President John Taylor's politically incorrect statement that the reasons why black people were allowed to survive Noah's flood was so that Satan could have representation on the earth. The vast majority of my extended family and many of my missionary companions probably wouldn't even raise an eyebrow to President Taylor's statement. I myself would not have given President Taylor's statement a second look when I was younger. But in time, the very act of disagreeing with the statement for me was, in essence, pushing my fist into stage four. Stage four can be an angry stage when the believing Latter-day Saint feels that on some level they have been betrayed or deceived by parents, local church teachers, leaders, or by high authorities in the church. I think of this stage as the throwing the baby out with the bathwater stage. The anger of the betrayal blinds the people to the good offered even by a flawed system. There are many reasons a person can enter stage four, and most people who enter stage four stay there their whole life. Those in stage four begin to look at the world from a naturalistic standpoint, devoid of metaphysical and paranormal events. Paul points out two indicators that allow a person to know if he or she is in stage four. One is that a person begins to view his or herself as outsiders looking at the church, possibly for the first time in their lives. The other indicator is agnosticism. For me, agnosticism is the crescendo of stage four. I spoke to Fowler at the Salt Lake 2002 Sunstone Symposium about this issue, and he told me that the only way out of stage four is to once again experience the metaphysical. He told me that in order to have a metaphysical event, one has to stand in its way. He used the imagery of having to stand on the railroad tracks in order to be hit by a train. In desperation, I naively asked his advice on this. He knowingly suggested that I start praying again. In Fowler's chapter about stage five, he talks about how difficult it is to understand even one stage ahead. For this reason, I have to talk about stage five in speculative terms. Fowler calls this stage conjunctive faith, and that those in stage five suspect that things are organically related to each other. He said that finding a simple description was a frustrating process, so he gives some metaphors. For example, he states that it's like looking at a field of flowers with a wide-angle lens and a microscope simultaneously, or discovering that one's parents are remarkable people, not just because they're your parents. I perceive that an element of stage five for Latter-day Saints is the process of forgiving people whom they feel have betrayed them, real or perceived, and finding possible ways to live among the LDS tradition. The problems and contradictions still exist, but the individual is able to find some value and meaning within the LDS community. I suspect that many generational Latter-day Saints at age four would not move on to another religion. This, in my mind, would for them be exchanging problems for problems, when one of the Mormon Church's strengths is community. Traditionally, Mormons are excellent at taking care of the tangible needs of the active members of their community. At seven, I ran through a sliding glass door, and within hours, members of the church anonymously cleaned up the glass and blood and made arrangements for replacing the door. 3 days later, my mother had to approach the Relief Society president, the local women's leader, and request that the amount of food being delivered to us be reduced. After my twins were born, I came home from the hospital to find my lawns mowed, my windows washed, and a congratulations banner hung, and a schedule of who would be bringing dinner for the next 10 days, all from people who had only known me for a few weeks. The community of saints, in my mind, is the baby in the bathwater. I feel that the Latter-day Saints who are moving into stage five would probably look for strategies. Though they might adopt the elements of other traditions, Fowler speculates that very few people make it to this stage, and most people in this stage stay there their whole lives. Stage six, or the universalizing faith, according to Fowler, is exceedingly rare. It is a stage of actualization and incarnation of the absolute love and justice that can only be sensed or approximated by those in earlier stages. Of those who are capable of stage six, he explains, life is both loved and held too loosely. Such persons are ready for fellowship with persons of any other stages and from any other faith tradition. As incarnations of divine love, persons in stage six often act with little regard for self-preservation or social convention. Their radical actualization of universal morality feels to many to be subversive. As Fowler points out, many persons in the stage die at the hands of those whom they hope to change. He refers to a few modern examples: Gandhi, Martin Luther King in the last years of his life, Mother Teresa, Abraham Herschel, and Thomas Merton. Because stage six persons are actualizers and incarnators of God, of God's perfect will and love, Fowler declares that it's not blasphemous for someone like Jesus to declare himself the way, the truth, and the life, or for a Sufi poet to claim to be a perfect mirror of God. Now that I have briefly looked at these stages, it probably seems clear that stages 3 through 5 are the stages that I have any immediate interest in. Stage 3 is the most popular stage and the most comfortable to be in. But I would argue, ultimately, it is not necessarily a healthy stage, as stage 3 Latter-day Saints often show little tolerance of any criticism from the larger community and perpetuate issues of misogyny, racism, and spiritual abuse, and often vilify those in later stages. Mormons who articulate their doubts do not seem to find any empathy or forgiveness by stage 3 Latter-day Saints. These skeptics are looked at with disdain and suspicion, regardless of any previous status or reputation. Fowler talks about how a person's age must dictate the stage a person can and will be in. For example, it would be impossible for a 21-year-old returned missionary to be in stage 5. These stages are directly related to a person's age and mental maturity. There are other factors. I would venture that it is probable for someone in their 20s to enter into stage 4, but I doubt that a Latter-day Saint, unless they took particularly challenging courses in college, especially in the humanities, would normally develop into stage 4 until their mid-30s. I would speculate that stage 5 would be something Mormons could move into in their 40s and 50s. Stage 6, if achieved, would be late in life. Mapping the stages of faith seems only to matter for those who are at or around stage 4. It's difficult to self-analyze where one is. I felt for some that I was in stage 5, but in time I became honest with myself and realized that I fit somewhat squarely in stage 4. I'm still angry. Most people in stage 3 see those who are in stage 4 as heretics, or claim that they were never truly converted in the first place. They can't really wrap their mind around the concept of losing one's faith for reasons other than sin, nor do they feel that the individual decisions that differ from the Mormon norm can be healthy in the maturation process. After having these stages laid out for them, many of the Mormons I have spoken with, obviously in stage 3, have expressed that they themselves are really in stage 5. One went so far as to express that she was in stage 6. I feel this is in response to the belief that because they have labeled me a heretic, or because I proclaim myself in stage 4, that I must be behind them in the faith development process. For example, after briefly explaining Fowler to an older brother, he told me that he was clearly in stage 5. Not to make fun of my brother, but his justification was that he had wrestled with difficult issues as a missionary and came out the other end a true believer. In his mind, this was going through the stage four process. It has been my experience that most active members and many of the LDS hierarchy view the world with stage 3 eyes, and thus they generally view those who move into stage 4 as dangerous and seem unwilling to allow them the opportunity to move through this process unmolested, even though this stage is absolutely necessary and for some an unavoidable step in the maturation process. I realize that stage 3 is necessary, and just like stage 4, this process cannot be skipped. But the reason that stage 4 is so painful for Mormons is directly related to the words and actions of those in stage 3. The Christian ideal of leaving the 99 in God's hands and going out to help the one seems to have been retranslated into something that ultimately leaves the one in stage 4 fending for itself. As I have mentioned, I consider myself in stage 4, and I feel that I cannot wrap my mind around the idea anymore that God might actually exist, that if he does, he might actually be willing to communicate with humanity, my community, or me personally. I know Latter-day Saints who I feel fit the stage 5 mold. Quietly, deep inside, I feel that they are sellouts. I feel that one of the possible reasons they return to a belief in deity is that they are in denial of the idea that after we die, that we cease to exist. and my immaturity, I often feel that I'm ahead of them in the process because of my acceptance of this idea. I realize that this is something akin to those in stage 3 thinking that I'm a heretic, and hope that one day if I repent, I will gain the knowledge of my sins and be enlightened just as they are. Paul Edwards, in his Murder Mystery, the Angel Acronym, says, "What I'm talking about is knowledge. Knowledge is lived, not forgiven. It's an old Druid idea, but an interesting one. Knowledge can't be forgiven. But we can be forgiven of our deeds, maybe our thoughts, but once you know something, there's no forgiveness, because there's no unknowing. The thing that draws me most to the ideas of stage theory is that for the first time in my life, I have the tool to describe experience. Though not a perfect system, I have a framework that I can verbalize and experiment with. For example, I can compare stages 1 through 3 with the Mormon concept of the 3 degrees of heaven. Stage 1 being celestial, stage 2 being terrestrial, and stage 3 being compared to the happiness of the social kingdom. Stage 4 is restarting the process with a painful celestial. Stage 5, the terrestrial, and 6 has celestial or exaltation. It's almost like God gave us a grade school version of the planet happiness, and upon entering stage 4, he's now giving us the college level version. I also like the ladder analogy. For some people may have a foot in stage 3, most of them are in stage 4, but have a fist in stage 5. Or someone can have a toe in stage 2, but be mostly in stage 3. Stages can be played out with a multi-dimensional fashion. A person's Mormonism can be in stage 5, but their unwillingness to critically look at the life of Jesus places their Christianity at stage 3. Mary Beth Raines points out that in stage theory, we are primarily in one stage of time, but we can have experiences from several other stages at any time, close quote. There does not seem to be any limits to stage theory's ability to describe the human journey. I feel that I can argue that the LDS Church itself loosely reflects stage theory. The Joseph Smith story has an element that attempts to mix myth with reality. The Church found out that part of the world would embrace it, yet there was a great deal of physical danger, all elements of stage 1. The Church in early Utah was clearly tribal, Mormons and Gentiles, and the Mountain Meadows Massacre has a feel of stage 2. I feel that the Church began to develop stage 3 mentality about the time of the Second Manifesto at the turn of the century. And now in the 21st century, we find that the Church is rethinking many of its traditional doctrines and policies, such as the nature of God, lack of Satan's representatives, and the literalness of our Orthodox history as we move swiftly into the Information Age. Currently, the Church's website contains 5 essays that concede that the American Indians are not necessarily descendants of the Lamanites found in the Book of Mormon. These statements are in direct contradiction with the statement that the Lamanites are the principal ancestors of the American Indians found in the introduction of our current edition of the Book of Mormon. I speculate that the Internet will be a significant factor that helps the Church grab a firm hold in stage 4. One could also point to the leadership of the Community of Christ, formerly the RLDS Church, as a Mormon religion that is pulling itself into a stage 5 prototype. Its efforts to grapple with history in real terms, its move toward diversification of its highest leadership, and a clear focus that God is real and effective in their lives appears to be a stage 5 organizational model. Conclusion. As I mentioned previously, stage 3 appears to be meaningful only once a person begins to experiment with issues relating to stage 4. I find it frustrating that my tradition is controlled mostly by stage 3 individuals who easily label and despise those attempting to make a more pragmatic look at the world around them. A person moving into stage 4 risks losing his or her status among family, friends, neighbors, and more importantly, their marriage and sometimes their employment. My transition into stage 4 has been a painful process and not one I would want to personally inflict on others. It's a difficult balance of wanting to be understood, while the very act of being understood offers the potential to the other to experience cognitive dissonance. A recent bishop asked me what my concerns were about the Church. If I fall to the temptation of venting any number of issues, I would be placing my kind-hearted bishop at risk of having to deal with questions that I feel that he has no answers to. Clearly, he would not be able to provide any light on issues that I have fumbled with for years as a serious insider in the LDS book. In all honesty, I feel that I have many of the answers. They're just not the answers I wanted. What right do I have to inflict these questions on my bishop and potentially his family? As a bookseller, I often see very bright young people in a collision course with stage 4. and there is no grasp by their leaders or community about their experience. They are often told that they should stop learning, stop listening to Satan, obey their leaders implicitly, and listen to the Spirit. This type of insulting rhetoric only alienated me further from those whom I would normally seek advice, and I'm sure it's having the same effect on others. We're not stupid. We're not listening to Satan. We're just going through a stage. I find that I'm fortunate to have had several years to absorb Fowler's work, accompanied with people willing to discuss these stages in a mature and serious way. I'm sure that many members of the church are forced to suffer quietly, as they have no outlet nor the tools to describe their situation. Fowler's stage theory gives us an opportunity to articulate our faith experience. Progress and maturity is based on one's ability to understand the events and feelings he or she is experiencing. The capacity to articulate to others our spiritual journey will facilitate our abilities to make sense of our world, and in time, empower questioning Latter-day Saints to live fuller, more meaningful lives. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the pyre in spring. Droughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again.
Tom and I have had fun talking about that for years. I first was introduced to James Fowler's work in 1988 as a graduate student, my very first month of graduate work at Arizona State University. It was just one of the approaches of the methodology, the books you read in methodology course that says you can take a psychological approach to religion. And I was so clearly stage three there that it just didn't, like Tom says, it's not until you kind of find yourself asking those questions and having your life a little bit complicated before this becomes there. So truly it was in 1997 when I happened to sit next to James Fowler on a plane. I don't know if any of you read, I wrote an editorial a couple of years ago in Sunstone about this experience and how important it was for me. You go through these stages, not naming them, and of course, you know, like I said, the rules for helping you sort of categorize and explain life. And Tom mentioned the Val Rust paper this morning. Clearly had all these elements of stage theory in it, but without articulating it in such a way. But anyway, at the point, I was at the point in my life where, oh, it was so wonderful to realize that I was on a path that was sort of the human developmental path. That at some point in your life, you have to step outside the water that you're swimming in. There's this great line in Fowler's book that says, we're not sure who discovered the properties of water, but we're pretty sure it's not the fish. In other words, when you're swimming inside it, there comes that point that it, as you begin to look outside things, it gets complicated, you're lost, you're wondering it. And it was so gratifying for me to realize that it was, you know, I'd always sensed that it was a healthy path. But, you know, you don't have the language, your family, your friends, you're just going like this. And it was just so wonderful to feel like, oh, I'm on this path of human development. And since then, it's just been very important. So I just dove into stage theory, started reading. And in fact, I'm only going to make two real points to this. This is a terrific paper. It works as a personal essay. It works hopefully as a little introduction and a teaser to stage theory, those of you who haven't heard it. So I really enjoyed the paper. So I don't have any criticism. I actually just want to echo a couple of things that Tom's really touched on. So I dove into stage theory, and the one thing that I want to do first, and I was going to do it second, but I just decided kind of on the way over, I'm going to do it first, is I want to talk about Tom's little telestial, terrestrial, celestial, and starting over kind of thing. Is that able to kind of, if you can get as much of it on there as you can, maybe push it forward a little bit. What I've done there is I've paralleled his stage one, stage four, and kind of some developmental tasks there. But the reason that this works in some ways for me is this other reading that I've done with Ken Wilber's work, and especially with a book called Changes of Mind by Jenny Wade, that talks about brain development. And if you look at the chart that Tom passed out about different ages, basically, it's late adolescence to early adulthood, and maybe Trent Stevens could help us here. I don't know, animals versus humans here, but basically, your brain finally is fully functioning. The neocortex is very late in becoming this feature within your brain that is able to sort of integrate both hemispheres and all the different parts of your brain. So you literally lack the capacity, you know, up until your late teenage years or your full early adulthood years, to even grasp the concept of paradox, and that there things can be true that don't match up with each other and things like that. So anyway, I like Tom's idea of starting over there as sort of childhood into early adulthood, and then really, if we were to take seriously these insights from brain science and stuff like that, that around to the time that most people, as you see from the chart with Fowler, enter into a stage four sort of position, that's when they actually are starting to use their full brain. So it's kind of like, you hate to, you know, there's some negative implications, like people that are the whole heck. But anyway, to me, it's kind of interesting. So let me just quickly take you through this as Tom just suggested to me. I'm kind of playing with it. I'm kind of excited about it right now, but I haven't had time to really fully get into it. I may even write to Fowler. He and I kind of became friends through inviting him to Sunstone a couple of years ago and things like that. And I may want to see if anybody's done something like this with this. But if you look at stage one and stage four, at the very beginning with the child, they're trying to, you'll see the task here is feeling and taking the measure of the universe. And Tom kind of talks about that. You learn whether the universe is safe. You're hopefully that dad and mom come back when they drop you off at the nursery at church, or those kids who's had the nursery experience. You know, and you're so grateful after a while they learn that dad's going to come back, or mom's going to come back at the end of the day. You're learning whether, you know, if you're going to get comforted when you're tired and things like that. And so you're just basically at this intuitive level, you're getting a feel for the universe. Well, stage four is what Tom's talking about. You're once more deciding for yourself. Down here at stage three, you are using who for your guide. It's your parents, it's your leaders. They've thought about it, they've worked it through, so I'm sure it's okay. It's kind of the authority of somebody else. Stage four, you're learning to make and to trust your own inner voice. You become the arbiter of right and wrong. You begin to sense, well, I'm temperamentally this versus that. Yeah, that person is a church leader, but you know, I'm so much more in sympathy with this guy's teaching. You begin to sort of get that. So again, both of these early stages have to become just that basic. What is the nature of the universe? And a lot of people who Fowler says second stage four are the ones who fall in love with this idea that, oh, with this new wonderful rational brain of mine that can do so many things, you get really excited about what the power of this brain, and you sometimes don't move on to, like Tom said, to get in the way of those metaphysical experiences where you can have God sort of talking to you again and things like that. So stage four is you're taking measure of the universe if you are at the early one. The second one, the mystic literal phase, stage two, which is again about ages 3 through 12, to the stage five, which again, for Fowler, it doesn't come along until you've lived your life and you've made some choices that you can't unmake. You've had defeats in your life. You know, I wanted to be a pro golfer when I was a kid. Well, guess what? I didn't practice enough. You know, there's just some things that I can't do. He calls it the sacrament of defeat that often has to sort of force you into there where you can finally move on again. But the point here of this is that it's a mythologizing stage. Tom talked about you're developing narrative, you're learning that there's a narrative flow to life, you can sort of be trapped within your story. Well, really, the real action here of conjunctive phase, which is the word itself is sort of means a joining together, or a joint, you know, junction, and then with, con. It's basically saying, I'm taking those stories of my youth, and I'm marrying them with my experience, which are much more complex, and I'm no longer trapped by the stories, but it's a revaluing stage. So this is the child's learning to value us versus them, and this is this, you're revaluing the stories in the stage five sort of thing. And then this boundary maintenance, like I mentioned, like Tom said, us versus them. In stage five, this is where the boundaries between us and them start to disappear. This is where you would really start to feel at this point in your life that it's pretty hard to be to hold that really exclusivist position, you know. Less than us, you begin to feel much more of a kinship with everybody. So I think that's, again, a nice little thing there. And then stage three, synthetic conventional stage, which is the one where you incarnate the values, here it is, of the group, that you're raised with, family, church, etc. Here, if you'll remember just that one paragraph that Tom gave us, six, it's the values of God. This is the Jesus, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. I am acting radically as an embodiment of the divine love, etc. And so, again, the same task here is to actualize the incarnate values. There it was of the group. Here it's of the ultimate values of the universe, the justice, the love, the mercy of those. So it's just a fruitful thing. So I appreciate Tom doing that, and I'm going to kind of play with it and read the book again very carefully to kind of do that. But again, I think with brain science, it adds something to me. That if you sort of sense, this is what happens while you're still growing up. Once your brain's growing up, these are the stages that we should be able to move towards. My other thing, this, the reason I kind of switched the order here, is I think this will lead to a better discussion in the moments that we have left. So,
this is over on the table. Oh, okay, sorry about that.
Stage model has a big pro and a big con. One of the wonderful pros, or maybe that's not the way to do this. I like it because it helps us see the readiness and the capacity of persons at each stage to be part of our community. In other words, you know, if you understand this, that it, you know, stage at age 13 or 14, your son or daughter is not supposed to be having philosophical discussions with you on a heavy duty level. You know, but again, at age 65, you shouldn't still be, you know, using the stories you learned in Mutual and MIA for your moral guides. You know, in other words, it sort of gives you a sort of a sense that we should pay attention to the capacities of each person to help us avoiding expecting too much too soon, is especially how I do. And so, you know, I've got a 16-year-old son. He's managing to make it so far through life with good friends and things. I'll be tickled to death for him to go on a mission and to write me those great missionary letters and say, "Oh, Dad, the gospel's so true. If you could feel it all." You know, and just that kind of, because that's the experience he's supposed to be having. You know, I can't value that in the same way anymore, but yet it's helped me really want that for him. And then if the complexity comes, it'll come at the normal and the right time with his life. What it warns us against, and what it alerts us to, is that there is this sort of average level of expectation. So let's read this. I lost my italics when I copied it to some other thing, but the modus operandi is the level, it's the average expectable level of development for adults in a given community. In faith terms, it refers to the conscious or unconscious image of adult faith towards which the educational practices, the religious celebrations and patterns of governance in a community all aim. The modal level operates as a sort of a magnet in religious communities. Patterns of nurture prepare children and youth to grow up to the modal level, but not beyond it. The operation of the modal level in a community sets an effective limit on the ongoing process of growth in faith. And so really, if you hear what Tom is saying here, he's saying, no one's understanding my stage four, because most of the people in church are stage three. And in fact, Fowler says, most religions in America operate stage three or just slightly above that, is what his observation from doing this is. So you have this sort of community group model that says this is how big and how complex the world should be, and this is what everything that we do in our community aims for. And so the point is, how do you break beyond that? And so Fowler, in this book towards the end, the very last chapter, and then especially these next two books, Faithful Change, and then his one called Becoming Adult, Becoming Christian, are his efforts. He also has another one called Reweaving the Vision, or something like that. I couldn't find it. I'm going to drop this immediately, which is more about how faith communities might do this better. But anyway, one of his goals is to say, let's get religions to understand and to really take seriously the need for adults to be able to move on to these other stages, and yet you still need people to sweep the floor at the end of the war dinner, you know, and to do the home teaching and to do all those things. And so there's this battle with how do we as a religion still get the commitment that I'm in the nursery and that's how I'm building the kingdom of God on earth. You need that, but yet you still have to be able to recognize that humans should to those higher stages at this point. And so this is what I thought would lead to a nice discussion in the few moments we have left. So how do we take this seriously? He mentioned 3 points, and I'll just close with those. He believes that we need to move, number one, from a faith that's centered in belief. You know, here's my checklist of what I believe, to one that's centered in relations. In other words, in our pledging ourselves to each other as a community. So that needs to be the transition from the static things that we believe and that we assent to what it means for us to be in a covenant community together. We should move towards lived truth. Beliefs should become guides towards ways of seeing and being. Past creeds are master stories of days gone by, but they should also be invitations for contemporary experiments with truth. So in other words, don't be trapped by all the things that they have said in the past. Use those for those, recognize for what they were, that they were the level and the talk then, but to use them and not be trapped by them. So one of these things, move from beliefs to lived religion. Second one, and this is what I think Sunstone does well, in fact my editorial in the current issue, which should get to your, this was in the back of my brain because Tom was giving me drafts of this while I was writing my editorial, but allow adults to bring their struggles with faith to word. Before prescriptions are given and without condemnation or accusation, give the help of active listening. You know, just to be able to do that. Wouldn't that be nice? Every once in a while we'll have a great priesthood meeting class or something where you can sort of do that. But just to be able to say that out loud in a setting where these are my fellow travelers, this is my community, to be able to give my doubts to faith is a very important thing that he believes religions can do. And then finally, create a climate of developmental expectation. You can sort of guess that that's what's going on here. Not a rush to push people from one stage to the next, but an understanding that it takes the full development of each stage seriously. It takes what children are up to, what teenagers are up to, what young adults are up to, what young marriages are up to, what people in their middle age who are starting to have life, kick them in the butt are up to, all the way on and up there. Take each level seriously. And it will involve creating vocations, and this is what some of his other books do, and callings and challenges that are appropriate for people at each level. In other words, recognize that at a certain point, somebody in their mid-50s or 60s should be doing a different kind of work, and he talks in different places, especially in the other books, about creative ways of thinking to give people something to do that's appropriate with their stage. So it's kind of a neat thing. So I thought those were some nice ideas for hopefully a good discussion. So thank you for letting me run.
Thanks.